Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Even if you don't follow the issues around nuclear weapons a lot, you've probably heard of MAD, mutually assured destruction. It's one of those popular concepts that everyone has heard of. But do we take MAD for granted, or are there reasons to question it? Does MAD explain the Cold War arms race? To discuss this, Pranav and I today are joined by a very special guest, Brendan Green. He's assistant professor at political science at the University of Cincinnati. His most recent work has focused on the dynamics of nuclear weapons, arms races during the Cold War, as well as today. And he's got a brand new book out on the subject titled The Revolution That Failed. Brendan's been published all over the Journal of Strategic Studies, Security Studies, International Security, and so on. One of his most widely read papers was called Stalking the Second Strike, which he co-authored with Austin Long back in 2015. And if you're looking for an academic paper that keeps you up at night, look no further than that. We'll definitely be talking about that paper today, as well as Brendan's book. But first, welcome to the podcast, Brendan.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
I want to start by asking you, what got you interested in nuclear strategy and nuclear weapons? Was it a longstanding interest, or did you just find your way to the subject?
Well, it's a little bit of a story, but when I went to graduate school in my early 20s, I made good friends with Austin Long, my co-author, and with a gentleman named Owen Cote at the Security Studies program at MIT. And we used to go out to dinner and have long conversations about nuclear weapons. And that's where I started to realize that a bunch of the things that I had thought were true about nuclear weapons, like mutually assured destruction, had some real potential issues with them. And so then about 10 years later, when I was on the job market and desperately seeking an academic position, Austin came to me and he said, "Hey, you know what? We should write up some of these dinner conversations that we had as an article. And if nothing else, that will give you something to talk about on the job market other than your dissertation." And so I said, "Well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's do that." And so we wrote Stalking the Secure Second Strike. And the article received a fair bit of attention and sort of basically drew me into the nuclear world. Which is suddenly people started picking up my grants. I won fellowships. It was like I was a little rat in a maze and had finally discovered the button that gives you the piece of cheese when you hit it. That's basically how I ended up as a scholar of nuclear weapons, is I sort of wrote a piece on old dinner conversations. And then when there was a popular reaction, sort of kept doing it.
So we know that the MAD, mutually assured destruction, in the colloquial term, mutually assured destruction is somewhat mischaracterized. Some call it a strategy, some call it a doctrine. The famous dictum is a MAD is a fact, not a policy. But MAD has a very specific meaning in both the academic sense and in the policy sense. So can you explain to our listeners what is mutually assured destruction in both the academic and the policy sense, and why it's very important to frame it in the right context?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And so I should say that for most of my purposes, when I talk about MAD, I'm using it as a synonym for the theory of the nuclear revolution, right? And so what I mean by MAD is it's a theoretical explanation about how international politics works under certain conditions. And so the theory goes like this. It says that once states have enough retaliatory capability, enough nuclear weapons to cause intolerable damage, and we can put a little asterisk there and say that nobody knows exactly what intolerable damage is, but at some point, we believe that states can get enough nuclear capability to be able to absolutely destroy their adversary if it came to a nuclear war. And once this point is reached on both sides, the states are in a condition of mutually assured destruction. And what this means is that states can no longer be stronger than one another, right? That if you invest more money in nuclear weapons, get yourself superior capabilities, it doesn't give you any political benefits. Because if the war comes, you're just as dead as you would be if you hadn't made those investments at all. And so if this theory is true, it has a number of very important implications, which is that it should take a lot of the competitive aspects of international politics out of the mix. Once states can no longer be stronger than one another, they have no incentives to compete for power. So you shouldn't see things like arms racing. There are a number of other predictions that it makes, some more successful than others. So, for instance, in this condition, states obviously shouldn't go to war with one another, or at least shouldn't have big wars. You shouldn't see that many crises because the state of mutually assured destruction is so frightening that states will want to stay away from them. You shouldn't see them caring very much about alliances because the balance of power doesn't matter very much anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And so, that's the way that I use the term, right, is to talk about this theory about how international politics works once states have secure retaliatory capabilities in their nuclear arsenals. There is another important way that the term is used, which is as a nuclear strategy, right? And so in this sense, this would be a strategy of pure retaliation, which is that you have your nuclear capability that's secure against attack, and you threaten to use it under the circumstances that you are attacked, right? And so that deterrent threat constitutes your nuclear strategy, or is at least sort of the large and central element of it. And so the terms are, the uses of the term are similar to one another, but there are important differences. So the theory of the nuclear revolution makes claims about international politics, whereas sort of the proposal for a nuclear strategy only makes claims about what the best nuclear strategy to follow is and why. So that's how I would talk about the distinction between the two ways of using MAD.
And this theory was also, first, before the theory of MAD came, there was also a theory of the nuclear revolution, right? That nuclear weapons have revolutionized international politics so much that wars are essentially not to be fought, which was the dictum of Bernard Brody.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can trace sort of the intellectual roots of the nuclear revolution, you know, back essentially to 1946 when Brody and his compatriots first start writing in The Absolute Weapon. So those ideas kind of developed into what we now sort of call the theory of the nuclear revolution, which is usually associated with Robert Jervis. Not that he thought it up, but he was kind of the one who made it most famous and started treating it as a theory. So yeah, so that's essentially what I mean when I talk about MAD, is this theory of the nuclear revolution and how the condition of MAD might impact international politics.
All right, so MAD is one of those theories that is very parsimonious, very elegant. It seems to make sense at an intuitive level, but what's the problem with it?
Well, I should say, first of all, that you're right, which is that the theory is parsimonious, it is beautiful, and it's very easy to understand. And I should also note that in some respects, I think it's quite powerful. We have not seen a great power war since 1945. And I suspect that a large part of the reason for that is that all of the great powers have secure nuclear capabilities. So I do think that the theory gets some things right. But what I think it gets wrong is that we haven't seen the large pacifying force on other elements of international politics. States still very much care about the conventional balance of power, even if they have secure nuclear forces. States still very much care about alliances, even though aggregating your capabilities through alliances shouldn't matter very much in a MAD world. And most importantly for me, states still engage in arms racing, even though MAD would tell you this is like setting a bunch of money on fire. You can't possibly get any benefits out of it. So from my perspective, I just wrote a book on this question. I wanted to figure out sort of, well, what was wrong with the theory of MAD? And I think there are a couple of things about the theory, just taken on its own terms, that don't quite add up. So in order for states not to want to compete, right, you basically have to believe that if competition happens, you're no worse off based on whatever your opponent does if you just do nothing, right? So if your opponent starts building nuclear weapons, you should say, well, that sounds like a good hobby for him. Why should I care about that? I'm going to go on living my life like normal. But it turns out that I think there are some very salient situations that states can get themselves into where they might end up caring, right? Which is that, you know, the reason not to care is, well, my opponent would have to be an idiot to make some sort of challenge to the status quo. He knows that he's not strong enough to do that and that I can defend the status quo very easily with just my retaliatory forces. But what about situations where the status quo is unclear, right? What about situations like happened in the Cold War, like the big Berlin crisis or the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s, where it's not really clear who's the challenger and who's the defender? In a situation like that, you might not be able to count on your opponent recognizing that he needs to back down. Similarly, you know, the reason why your opponent would back down in a crisis under MAD is that it's just simply too risky, right? Which is that, if this comes to war, we could all get ourselves killed very easily, and there's no way that we could win, right? So why take these mortal risks for what are passing political benefits? But this raises the question of where exactly the risk of destruction comes from. And, you know, if for you to be afraid of your opponent using nuclear weapons, you have to have a story about how they're going to overcome the problems associated with MAD, right? Won't they also believe it's risky as well? And I think that more or less the only way to solve this problem is to assume that there's something that might be irrational in the system, that there's some, your opponent's military might act for non-rational reasons or for organizational reasons that don't reflect the state's best interests. But if that's the case, if you're worried about something irrational in your opponent's military system, then why wouldn't that also apply to other situations besides the decision for him to use nuclear weapons? The point being is that if you're dealing with a state that might not act according to the dictates of MAD, that's going to have a lot of implications for all sorts of political situations. And it might mean that you would need to compete in order to hedge against those kinds of outcomes. So basically, to sum up, I think that if you take the theory on its own terms, there are essentially a couple of logical loopholes in it, which show you that there are certain situations in which you can't count on your opponent doing the rational thing. And so if you can't count on your opponent doing the rational thing, you might need to provide your opponent with incentives to do the right thing, which could lead to competition. So that's what I think at a basic theoretical level.
In your book, you do talk about two different types of MAD. You talk about parochial MAD and pure MAD. What are these?
Yeah, it's a great question. The problem that I faced in the book was, well, I wanted to see why we had arms races, even though MAD said there shouldn't be arms races, right? So in order to figure out the problem, I had to create a theory and test it against the theory of MAD. But as I've described the problem, you can probably see the challenge, which is that everybody acknowledges that the arms races we observed in the Cold War were inconsistent with the theory of MAD. So we sort of know that that theory is wrong. And so in order to get a good competitor for my theory, what I did was I took the conventional explanations that theorists of MAD would offer for why the arms races occurred anyway. And these were essentially domestic political explanations, which is that the story would be, well, no, MAD is true, and decision makers recognize that it's true, which is why nuclear politics are so stable. But there are other forces within the body politic that force political leaders to engage in stupid arms races that they don't really want to do. right? So this could be pressure from, for instance, Congress or the legislature. This could be, you know, military industrial complexes who just want to buy more weapons because it's good for their bottom line. It could be sort of other explanations of this nature. And so I call these parochial explanations, right? And that's where the term parochial mad comes from, which is that some sort of interest acting for its own benefit and not the national interest is somehow able to hijack policy and force the arms race. And so that was basically what I meant by parochial mad. And then pure mad was just what the theory predicted, without any such parochial factors, even though it was wrong, right? So when I went to look at all these cases of different administrations in the arms race, if pure mad is right, then we ought to see decision makers thinking in a certain way, even if parochial factors later intervene and change the outcome in a way that the pure theory wouldn't predict. So basically pure mad and parochial mad are two different ways of talking about the same basic set of ideas. They just sort of imply different observational things we should see in the historical data.
Okay. So obviously, like you pointed out, the main problem with mad is that it empirically doesn't work, at least in the context of the Cold War, because you had this very expensive and dangerous arms race. So what is your theory? Why did you have that arms race in the Cold War if it wasn't parochial interests?
Well, so I basically think that there were three sets of factors that were driving the Cold War arms race, right? One is that Mad's basic assumption about the security of second strike forces was empirically not true, which is that second strike forces, at least from the point of view of the United States, were a lot easier to threaten and a lot easier to hold at risk than most people realized for much of the Cold War. So in fact, the United States was very good at sort of developing accurate missiles, which could potentially destroy all of the missiles that the Soviets had under hardened concrete. It got quite effective at chasing Soviet submarines around under the water, which is traditionally submarines are held to be the most secure form of nuclear delivery platform. The Soviets never had much of a bomber force, so destroying the bomber force wouldn't have been that difficult. And so while the task of going after thousands of nuclear weapons is a quite difficult task, it was not an impossible one. And as long as decision makers understood that it wasn't impossible, they realized that you might be able to get political benefits from pursuing a first strike capability, even if you never got there, right? Which is it would put all kinds of different pressure on your opponent, divert his resources, scare him, make him more cautious, do a bunch of other things that you might consider beneficial. So that's sort of one reason, which is that the technology of nuclear delivery was less stable than Mad thought. The second reason goes back to this point about the irrational element in the system, which is that even if you believe in Mad and believe that using nuclear weapons is crazy and that no one can possibly make that choice, if your adversary believes something different, this could be very bad for you, which is that if you got into a crisis with your adversary and your adversary believed that it was possible to fight and win a nuclear war, then you would have excellent reasons to back down in the crisis because you know that it's impossible to win. But your adversary would have excellent reasons to push strongly and to challenge you harder and to drive a harder bargain. And so that meant that your adversary's false beliefs about the world could potentially give him an advantage. And so one of the things that I think was going on in the Cold War is that both sides came to view the other as holding pernicious beliefs about nuclear war. And so the only solution that they perceived to the problem of these pernicious beliefs that could advantage their opponent was to compete hard and convince their opponent that even under these false beliefs, they shouldn't count on being able to be stronger. right? And so this is kind of what I think led to a bunch of the, you know, almost bizarre and baroque war fighting doctrines that we see at the end of the Cold War, is that I think both sides are trying to convince the other side not to have crazy beliefs, or at least not to take risks based on those crazy beliefs. The final thing that I would say is that mattered for driving the Cold War arms race is the domestic character of both societies, what I call constitutional fitness in the book. And this basically explains why the United States chose to engage in competition and arms control at the same time, which is that the arms control efforts, the SALT treaties that we saw in the 1970s and negotiations in the early 1980s, these were essentially aimed to manage the competition in a way that was consistent with U.S. domestic politics. That is, the U.S. administrations tended to fear that they wouldn't be allowed to compete, that Congress would intervene and stop it, that the public wouldn't stand for it if they weren't also doing arms control. And so they went about negotiating arms control deals that left open paths of technological innovation that the United States was very good at, but that closed off a quantitative arms race, or at least put a big limit on it by capping the forces, which was stuff that the Soviet Union was very good at. And so the process of arms control was really a process of both sides trying to channel the nuclear competition towards a kind of competition that their society was good at. And so those three factors, when you put them together, technological instability, secure second strike forces are not as secure as people think, sort of perceptual instability, what your opponent thinks about nuclear weapons really matters for how stabilizing they are, and comparative constitutional fitness, what kinds of arms racing your society is good at doing. These were the factors that interacted to push a very intense arms race that we saw in the last 20 years of the Cold War.
I find the bit about arms control quite interesting because, once again, going back to more than 50 years, we had the Thomas Schelling and Morton Halperin laid down the objectives of arms control, that it was there to achieve strategic stability and it was supposed to be cooperative so that both sides are better off if they cooperate. But what we saw was they were competing for advantages. They would direct arms control negotiations in a way which gave them direct advantages over certain kinds of technologies, or whether it's quantitative or qualitative. So how much do you think is the objective of maintaining strategic stability still relevant? Because based on the evidence that you've gathered, it would seem that the administrations over time were more interested in getting out of MAD than trying to stay within this novel framework.
I'll just say that I find arms control to be fascinating and also very strange. And I find it this way for exactly the reasons you lay out, which is that we have a way of talking about arms control. It's the Schelling and Halperin way of talking about it, right? Which is that we're going to sit down together and we're going to negotiate treaties that make the world more stable, right? That give us both sort of advantages over not having a treaty, because we don't want to live in a world where everyone's sitting on a hair trigger, right? And you really can't have an arms control discussion without talking about these basic sorts of ideas. But political decision makers have never really been very interested in these ideas. And in domestic politics, all of the energy behind arms control and in opposition to arms control has very little to do with strategic stability. It has to do with disarmament, which is that the left tends to like arms control because it likes disarmament and it thinks disarmament would be a good idea. The right tends to hate arms control for the same reasons. And so that whenever you sit down to think about any arms control negotiation, the motives of all the actors, both in Congress and in domestic politics and in the White House, look very, very different from the traditional story about strategic stability. So I would not go so far as to say that the story about strategic stability is irrelevant. I do think that matters in the sense that you just can't talk about arms control without telling this story about what it is you're doing, But in my experience, at least in studying the last half of the Cold War, this was not what motivated decision makers, right? Which is that decision makers don't really like strategic stability because it takes away options, right? It potentially puts you in very uncomfortable situations. And so decision makers would like, they would prefer, if possible, to escape mutually assured destruction. But if they can't escape mutually assured destruction, they at least want a bunch of options should we have a crisis and should things get really bad. And strategic stability goals often interfere with those kinds of options. So I think that the prospects for sort of traditional Schelling and Halperin style arms control are quite limited because there's just not very much interest in getting those kinds of deals done.
That's a very interesting factor, that Schelling and Halperin's dictum wasn't really followed all the time. What I find most interesting is the story of the Carter administration. In 1977, the Carter administration clearly comes in with a very dovish position. They are clearly against any form of war fighting. But by the end of the administration, they take up a position that's extremely destabilizing in one sense. And in your book, you have a very nice line, and I would like to quote that. You say, quote, "In the countervailing strategy, the administration had created a nuclear doctrine that would make Herman Kahn and his 44 levels of escalation blush. At the same time, the administration left the beloved SALT process enough of smoking, radiating ruin to make Curtis LeMay proud." How did this happen? How did a administration that clearly had peaceful intentions go out to create one of the most destabilizing doctrines in U.S. nuclear strategy history?
Well, first of all, thank you for quoting some of my more purple prose from the book. I was clearly very amused with myself when I wrote that line. So I don't know what others will think of it, but there it is. It's a great story, right? Which is that the Carter people are about the least likely set of folks, given what you would think you know about them when they come into office, to end up pursuing a really aggressive nuclear strategy. But that's what happens. And I think the secret basically lies in arms control. What happened at the beginning of the Carter administration was that the United States made a very ambitious arms control proposal for SALT II. So to give a brief background, SALT I was signed in 1972. It was the ABM treaty, along with an interim agreement, basically capping the number of nuclear weapons. But that interim agreement, which was set to expire in 1977, was always supposed to be the first step towards a more comprehensive set of limits on nuclear weapons. And the Nixon and Ford administrations, led sort of by Henry Kissinger on a lot of arms control matters, had negotiated a draft treaty for SALT II that was, it was very much in the mode of SALT I, which is it put limits on different categories of nuclear weapons, but it didn't really try to control the technology of nuclear weapons, and it didn't really try to add strategic stability, the treaty itself didn't pursue much in the way of strategic stability, right? And so the Carter administration just considered that treaty to be not very good, right? And they're the only people who have ever tried to really pursue strategic stability goals during, as traditionally defined, during the Cold War. And so what they did was they offered kind of what they considered to be a real arms control treaty, one that would limit sort of big counterforce weapons, that would dramatically reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons, and that would kind of limit other stuff that the ways states might operate their nuclear weapons in dangerous ways, right? So there are a bunch of big proposals to basically go after strategic stability goals. And when they went to Moscow, when Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, went to Moscow with these proposals, he really, really aggravated the Soviets, right? Which is that the Soviets perceived the Carter administration to be welching on the deal that they had negotiated with the Ford administration. And there was a big downturn in relations. There were dueling press conferences. Everybody got really angry with each other. Salt got thrown off track for many months. And from the Carter administration's perspective, though, this looked like the Soviet Union saying, we don't want to pursue real arms control goals, right? It was a big sign that the Soviets did not think the right things about nuclear weapons. And as you look through the intelligence reports that start coming on Carter's desk after this, you see that Carter is starting to absorb more and more these ideas that the Soviets simply don't believe in MAD, right? And once you believe that that's the case, whether or not it's true, well, then you have a big problem on your hands, which is if the Soviets don't believe in MAD, that means they might act in quite dangerous ways if you got into a crisis with them. And as I said earlier, if they're acting dangerously, right, because they don't believe in MAD, but you do believe in MAD, well, you might have to back down. And so the Carter administration gradually comes to the conclusion that it has to have a mechanism for convincing the Soviets not to act dangerously. It has to be competitive enough that even on whatever crazy theory the Soviets hold about nuclear weapons, the United States still looks strong and difficult to dislodge. And so that's where the shift in Carter's nuclear policy comes from. And over the course of 1978, right, the Carter administration basically disassembles its framework for strategic stability in SALT II in order to allow itself to compete. And it basically puts together a new nuclear doctrine called the countervailing strategy that it, once you get sort of deep into the weeds of what this doctrine would actually mean, is sort of utterly crazy. It's a story about nuclear war fighting and how you're going to integrate conventional and nuclear weapons in a global, long-lasting war. And, you know, it's a story that I don't think very many people in the administration believe. But they went about crafting the story and creating new nuclear policies to back it up. I think basically because they became convinced that the Soviets were sort of nuts and had to be given reasons not to behave badly. And it all came out of, I think, their interpretation of Soviet behavior in arms control settings.
So I think that you explain the Cold War arms race very well in your book. But how far does that apply to our situation today? If you look especially at India and China, these are countries that have made no first use pledges, that have fairly small nuclear arsenals and don't seem to think that nuclear war fighting are a thing. So, you know, if you look at now military competition between the United States and China, between India and China, between India and Pakistan, might get ugly, might get violent. But are they destined to engage in nuclear arms races like in the Cold War?
Well, I don't think they're destined to do so. I think that such arms racing can be avoided. And, you know, the big question is, you know, what's the difference between the Cold War and today? The biggest difference is that we don't yet have an all-consuming political competition, either between the U.S. and China or on the subcontinent. You know, and so with that context missing, you know, I think that kind of the way that forces have developed in South Asia might be able to continue at least for a time. But what I worry about is that the competition, political competition in the world really seems to be heating up. The rivalry between the United States and China is starting to get reasonably intense. The Modi government has taken a very sort of robust view towards competition with Pakistan. And I think that India has always been very sort of naturally suspicious of a lot of stuff that China is doing. And China is, in fact, slowly but surely expanding its nuclear force and trying to at least have more of a nuclear backstop against the United States than it's had before. And so my worry is that if political competition continues to intensify, we'll start to see some of these same competitive aspects that we saw in the last half of the Cold War come to fruition again in Asia. So you guys are no doubt familiar with Vipin Narang, and he and Christopher Clary recently wrote an article about sort of new competitive aspects of India's nuclear strategy. You know, I think that you can see that the Russians are sort of going down this road as well. And the United States is engaged in the process of a 30-year, you know, multi-trillion dollar nuclear modernization. And so while none of this has yet reached Cold War levels or anything close to it, I think you can see the seeds of new competition starting to grow. And if the argument of my book is right, then I think we can expect that growth to continue. And that is, of course, quite worrisome and potentially very destabilizing.
Well, that's quite worrisome. But we also have the question of arms control, which is most relevant right now, because in less than a year, the new START is going to expire. And people are generally talking about trilateral arms control, prospects for new arms control. But in your more recent works, for example, on clandestine capabilities, you reveal that it's harder to negotiate arms control when states are unable to signal the capabilities that they have. And what we see today is that Russia, China, and the United States are developing extremely novel capabilities in terms of in the space domain, in conventional weapons or dual-use weapons, as well as cyber capabilities. And unlike the Cold War, it's quite difficult to demonstrate these capabilities openly. So how would countries actually go about negotiating arms control agreements when it becomes extremely difficult to reveal vulnerabilities and reveal capabilities that would leave the other extremely vulnerable? What would that do to arms control today? Because, you know, one aspect of the discourse that is not really covered much by the academic community or the policy community.
Yeah, I mean, I think your intuition that we are in for a bad time for the arms control agenda is probably true. You mentioned sort of the issue of clandestine capabilities, which are military capabilities that rely on secrecy for their effectiveness. And so the more this kind of capability matters, I think the more you run into all kinds of problems, but the more difficult it is to negotiate arms control agreements, because you can't even talk about the things that really matter for the military balance. So I'm very pessimistic, at least for the next few years, about getting arms control agreements going in the international system. I will say that there's kind of a silver lining to my competitive expectations, which is that if competition does get intense, I do think states will have incentives to try and find arms control agreements. I'm not quite sure how they're going to get around all of these problems, but they'll have very strong reasons to want to stop the competition from getting out of control. So I think we, you know, in a more optimistic scenario, I think we might see a bunch of competition in the system. But after that competition has gone on for some time, we might see arms control efforts to try and tamp it down. But I do think that such efforts are going to face really considerable hurdles, and especially on issues where military capabilities are very secret, it may well be impossible to have effective arms control.
Okay. We've talked about nuclear weapons and arms control on this podcast quite a lot for the last 1 year, and I don't remember a single episode where any of us have said we're really optimistic about arms control in the near future. But yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. Your book and what you tell us today really tells us to re-examine, to question a lot of things that we think we know about the past and the future of nuclear weapons. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me and giving me the opportunity to talk about my ideas.
Wonderful. And we hope to have you again. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.